Preset 1077 for Good Morning New Hampshire. Peter St. James and Pat Kelly. Weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on 1077 The Pulse.
Well, I freely admit that I've been like a little kid in a candy store when I found out we had the opportunity to speak to our next guest today. So I've just been, it's like, ooh, the ambassador's going to be here. You know I'm not right, okay? And things like this just appeal to me to have a chance to sit and speak with somebody of his stature. It's just the prospect has thrilled the hell out of me. It is my pleasure to welcome Ambassador Thomas Pickering, who has served as ambassador to Russia, India, Israel, Nigeria, Jordan, and El Salvador. What, you couldn't hold a job? What? you have been 40 years, I believe, in the State Department?
I have, Peter, a little over 40 years.
40 years. Mm-hmm. Wow. You're in New Hampshire to speak tonight, 6 p.m., in Iran, Saudi Arabia, and U.S. interest in the Persian Gulf. I had a chance to sit with a colleague of yours, James Jeffries.
Sure. I knew Jim well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was at the U.S. Army War College, mm-hmm. and he was a keynote speaker, talking about the entangling alliances in the Mideast and how nothing is simple. You can't just say, oh, we'll do this, without realizing where the dots are connected. And you're nodding your head. Obviously, you know that better than most of us.
Every decision has a multitude of unforeseen consequences. If you don't know anything about the region, you're absolutely guaranteed to make a serious mistake.
Well, he showed us, had a wonderful presentation, and it had Hezbollah, Hamas, PLO, and all of the, Iran over here, Qatar over here, Syria here, and all of these lines. So, okay, we'll do, okay, but no, through proxy, it's, wow, there is no clear-cut way to go. So now you've got the president saying, all right, we're out of Syria. Oh, nature abhors a vacuum, and that's what you'd be creating.
Terrorists love a vacuum.
Yeah, they do. Well, yeah. As evidenced by Libya, look what happened.
Look at it, yep.
We took out Gaddafi, all right, and then we said, okay, we're gonna support the good guys. Who are the good guys?
Be careful about wanting to change regimes, because who comes next is usually worse.
Well, it just seems like there was not a lot of forethought. We're going to take care of this regime without paying attention to what's down the road.
But in some cases, that's the issue. Certainly, the Libyan thing was complicated. It always is. But it was complicated by the fact that Gaddafi was on the road to Benghazi. And Benghazi is where we had friends. And Gaddafi threatened to create mayhem, actually bordering on genocide. So we said, okay, let's defend our friends. We were so successful that we then got engaged in that great game of mission creep. If we can stop Gaddafi from committing genocide in Benghazi, why can't we help our friends get rid of Gaddafi entirely and take over the country? And, of course, that's what happened. The problem was that there were too many disparate, different friends who wanted to run the country, and they all ended up with slices of it.
And we kept talking about we're going to support our friends in the region, but I never really knew who our friends were, that we were giving arms and munitions and money to.
Well, they were smaller groups of people who joined us in a dislike for Gaddafi, but were never able totally to get themselves together around a common view about how Libya should be governed for the future and who should be in charge. And that's often the way. When you throw a hand grenade in the water, it makes big ripples.
Wow. Well, you today in the Union Leader, another view, don't kill the Iran deal. A knee-jerk reaction is the Iranians are getting away with murder. We gave them too much money, so we're going to get out of the deal. And you advise caution.
Great caution. First, of course, my view is they aren't getting away with murder. They have accepted limitations that will prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. There are admittedly time limits on that, which worries me and worries the president. But it isn't a time limit that comes to end tomorrow. It's 13 years from now. So we have 13 years to fix the deal. So the deal is, in my view, working very well. And both our intelligence community and the international monitors say Iran is in compliance. So what are we worried about? The money was actually Iran's money. It was in escrow. And people were telling us 3 years ago, when this deal was on the verge of coming to pass, that this money would all go into increased terrorist activity all over the Middle East. So far, I haven't seen our intelligence community, which leaks mightily on this subject, tell us, in fact, that that money has gone to create new outbursts of terrorist activity all over the Middle East. Admittedly, we've got a lot of terrorist activity in the Middle East, but it hasn't, in my view, been a huge empowerment of people who are against us. Much of that money was paying off debts, both to us and our firms, but even more importantly, to our European friends and allies. And I think that sucking that money up, if you could put it that way, in legitimate payment of debts was helpful. The rest of that money has gone to meet what are clearly political needs in Iran, that people were disadvantaged, they weren't getting food. There were a lot of things that they thought they needed that they couldn't pay for. And so the government felt an obligation there. Now, I can't tell you that some of it hasn't gone into bad things. But what I can tell you is that the people who do bad things in Iran are at the top of the budget list anyway.
No, that's,
it's an interesting point.
Now, if we withdrew, there's no check and balance on Iran then, right?
None left except if Iran were to keep the agreement with the other parties. But the real point is that if one party leaves an agreement, none of the other parties are bound by the
right.
terms of the agreement.
Right.
So it's a little bit like saying, we've got a little fire going in the kitchen. Why don't we throw gasoline on it to see if it will shut it down?
Let me think. Yeah, no.
Because this agreement prevents Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. If we do away with this agreement, Iran is free to do whatever it wants in the nuclear area, something we sweated blood over and many right. years of effort to shut them down, along with a lot of neighbors. And the view is, okay, let's get rid of this lousy agreement. I don't believe it is that way, but that's the view. And then let's go squeeze Iran some more to see if we can get the perfect agreement. The real problem was that squeeze all came in a coalition with our friends who were prepared to join us in sanctioning Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they've told us? They have told us if you leave the agreement, you will violate the agreement. If you violate the agreement, Iran will be free to do what it wants. We don't agree with you.
This is from our friends.
Our friends.
Yeah. Okay.
And they tell us we're not going to put new sanctions on if you destroy the agreement. They are, however, I think, persuadable to help us tighten up the agreement over the next 13 years to deal with the problem of the time limit running out on the amount of low-enriched uranium the Iranians can hold. And if that time limit runs out, Iran will be in a position to break out of the agreement more rapidly than currently.
Can the president nix the deal, or
yes.
does he need congressional approval?
The president can nix the deal because the deal depends on our delivering our side of the deal.
Okay.
And our side of the deal is that certain nuclear sanctions we have had on Iran are waived in accordance with the deal.
Okay.
We pay in sanctions, they pay in limits on what they do in the nuclear business, and they pay on the most extensive international monitoring and inspection system ever created in the area of non-proliferation arrangements. So if we violate our part of the deal,
sure.
then we've nixed the deal.
But does Congress have a say in this?
Congress has a say only if they took away the president's power to waive the sanctions.
Okay.
And that would then either be to put the sanctions on permanently with no waiver,
mm-hmm.
not a good idea,
mm-hmm.
Because then if the Iranians violate, we're stuck. Or, in fact, to take the sanctions off permanently, not a good idea either. I think the way out here is that the president has not liked the fact that he has to do two things under this deal, put on, in my view, by his own party in a judgment that the other party president would be forever subject to these onerous requirements. And one of those requirements is to determine whether the Iranians are in compliance. And the other is on 120 days for some sanctions and 180-day periods for other sanctions to continue to waive the sanctions. His waiver under the law is only good for, in some cases, 120 days, and in other cases, 180 days. Now, if they were to take those off, then the Congress could move and say, we will allow a period of 90 days after a preliminary finding that Iran is in breach, either to cure the breach, which would be the first effort, or secondly, to allow the Congress to take action with the president to put on even more egregious and onerous sanctions to press Iran to come back in compliance. And at that time, we would also have the right under the agreement automatically to put back in place a whole series of United Nations-approved sanctions, which are compulsory for all United Nations members to put in place. So it would be, in a sense, a kind of nuclear option that would strengthen our capacity to reinforce the agreement rather than an option in which we constantly harass the president to do things that he finds embarrassing, even if not totally in accordance with what I might call the facts.
Interesting.
I hope that's helpful.
It is. Scary, but helpful.
Scary, but helpful. Okay.
About 4 years ago, you were at a public conference, and one of your lines, if I remember correctly, was you said a critic once said that Wagner's music is better than it sounds.
A lot better than it sounds.
It was a loose quote, but I remember it.
Thanks, Peter.
And you referenced that in terms of our relationship with Russia.
Yeah.
Because you said it's actually better than what is reported on the evening news. 4 years later, can you still say that?
No, but I can say that on the one hand, there are things that we still cooperate with Russia on, for example, certainly on anti-terrorist actions, certainly on exchanging intelligence to help us inform those actions, certainly on Arctic policy, where there are potentials for real competitions over drilling for hydrocarbons in the Arctic seabed, certainly on managing and having access to the International Space Station, certainly on dealing with the Iran nuclear question, interestingly enough, because the Russians don't like that, potentially on joining together to deal with the North Korean nukes. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we're cooperating on. Now, we all know, in fact, that we're having huge problems in other places, certainly in Ukraine and Crimea, without doubt.
Right.
Certainly in Russia's efforts to drive wedges between us and the Europeans, which is not prospering happily. The more the Russians, in fact, become, put it this way, adventuresome, killing Mr. Skripal, or trying to kill Mr. Skripal and his daughter. That brings us together happily, and we are joined together in defending the Baltics and the NATO line, and that's important. We have differences over Syria, and that's immediate and significant today.
But we'll
see what the president is going to
do. But Russia's like a child. We all test our parents.
We do.
And okay, this doesn't work. We'll go over here. Russia's doing it. So it's not working in the Baltic. We'll go over here.
Exactly. See what we can gain here.
Yeah.
See what we can gain there. And we have an interesting situation because we have a president with one view and the rest of the government, more or less, with a different view.
Right.
And the president seems to move. So last week he was getting out of Syria. Now he's going to attack people in Syria because they've misbehaved. We're either in or out, or are we?
Right.
I don't know.
It's got to be confusing from a State Department standpoint.
It is very confusing. We have another situation where he's going to meet Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea. And China is potentially an important force in bringing North Korea around to the direction we want to go. The Chinese like the North Koreans as a buffer zone on their border.
Sure.
But they don't like loose nukes anywhere, or they don't like more nukes anywhere, that, not in their hands.
That they can't control.
And
right.
So
right.
Here we are, a few weeks after meeting, the meeting being kind of talked about and agreed to, we are sanctioning the hell out of the Chinese on trades and tariffs on a theory that we have to have equally balanced trade with every country in the
right.
world. Or maybe favorable trade with every country in the world. And we know that the statistics can't be made up to add up that way on a situation where the rest of the world keeps the ledger books, so to speak.
Well, and I sit back, and obviously on my level I know nothing, but I'm saying, God, I hope this is a bargaining chip, a tool. That this is the opening salvo waiting for the Chinese to come back saying,
there are elements
okay.
of that, and there were elements of that in steel and aluminum tariffs.
Right, right.
And to some extent, you ask for much more than you expect to get.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real estate deal phenomenon.
Right.
And then you settle for a good bit less than you asked for. Internationally, that takes place as well. But the variations between the extremes and the deal are not so wild that the president has to accept the notion you asked for twice as much and you got a quarter. That's not, in my view,
right.
reasonable politics. But maybe it will work here. There are things that I think have been helpful. The president has, in fact, threatened military action against North Korea. Does that have a role in Kim Jong-un's invitation to have a meeting? I would suspect it does, Peter. I think we have to look at that. Mm-hmm. But the real question is, what if Kim Jong-un said no? What's the next step? Either you use military action or you back away.
You have to be careful when you play that
card. When you play mm-hmm. the hard mm-hmm. card.
Absolutely.
In real estate, you can say, well, we just never got the deal. The other guy's really a schlemiel.
Right.
He's a schmuck. We have to live with him.
Very colorful,
and,
Tom. I like that.
I have to do it. I don't
great.
Use
no.
words like
no,
that,
I appreciate that
on other people's radio.
No,
but
that,
Peter,
no.
You've invited me here.
Absolutely,
so
sir.
I have to relax a little bit of
thank
the
you.
Early morning.
I appreciate that.
And so the rest of the world you have to get along with. You got 191 friends and customers. It's not like the real estate business. And what you screw up today may be something you have to repair tomorrow. Mm. And you want to be careful and cautious about how you go ahead. We also know that no successful real estate deal generally ends up in a zero-sum solution. I get everything, you get nothing,
right.
Peter. And so in the international sphere, the question is probably in a short of unconditional surrender, you don't have a zero-sum outcome. And so how do you shape the deal? So going in, of course I would be high.
Oh, absolutely.
It makes sense.
Sure.
I wouldn't show my bottom line.
No.
The really interesting question, however, is I would know that having wanted to go in, I have a point where I will accept a win-win deal, give up something for something. On my side, it will be a little better for me. Maybe on the other side, it'll be a little better for them. The art of diplomacy is to convince the other side that he had all the best ideas and to convince the other side that when you end up a little bit ahead, it was a great advantage for him.
Well, as my attorney friends will tell you, if you walk away from the table and nobody's happy, it's a good deal.
It may be. And if you agree to a deal in which everybody grouses like hell,
right.
it's probably an okay deal.
Right. And right. as you said in one of your talks, you referred to win-win approaches, win-win strategies, and win-win opportunities.
Yes. See, that's what we're looking for. Peter, thank you.
I may be the only one in the studio.
It's so gratifying. I'm so glad I came to New Hampshire because I never have heard that before.
No, it was October 22nd, 2013 is when you did that. But anyway, talking about Kim Jong-un for a moment, when the rhetoric was being ratcheted up and the Hawaii is on alert, we down in the trenches are sitting there saying, okay, Trump is saying this and Kim Jong-un is saying this. I want to believe that there's backdoor dialogue going on somewhere. Is there, or is what we heard what was actually transpiring?
Yes and no.
That's not a help, Tom.
No, because I'm going to explain it.
Okay.
That's the come on.
Okay, I
that's
got it.
That's to get you to say that's not a help, Tom.
All right, okay. Fine.
The answer is that there have been, for a long period of time, dialogues that are not official.
Okay.
We call them track two, which means both sides are not represented by people employed by the governments. But with North Korea, it's impossible. It's usually track 1.5. They're employed by the government. We
right.
aren't.
Right.
Okay.
And the North Koreans search these out because they're interested in staying up with us, and they have very little capacity to monitor what we're doing and understand what we say. They have a diplomatic mission in New York, and that's about it for the U.S. So that's helpful. In addition to that, Peter, there are clear evidences that on certain circumstances, including particularly the American interest in getting the three Americans now being held by North Korea, and mm-hmm. before that, poor Mr. Otto Warmbier out, mm-hmm. that we have had conversations at the official level
okay.
to try to break those loose. Now we are in a situation where we will have conversations at the astronomical level, the two heads of state. Never before have two serving heads of state of North Korea and the United States met. This will be a fascinating opportunity. The really interesting question is, at the heads of state, you usually come to a deal you've carefully prepared.
Right.
Is there a way forward here? Well, in my view, it is better to talk than not to talk. It is okay to talk at the top if that's basically where you can begin. The top at the top can be used not to complete the deal, but to set the outlines, to give the directions, to create the principles that will guide the negotiators who have to deal with the dotting the I's and the crossing of the T business,
sure.
which is so important in getting a right deal. And indeed, it's a mistake to send two people at the top whose preoccupation is high-level politics, not nuclear monitoring or expertise in how to make nuclear weapons, in to set the stage and to kick it off. And to say, yeah, we're going to do it. So we want a firm commitment on the part of the North Koreans to denuclearization, but we want it clearly in the context that what we have to pay for it is going to be reasonable as well. Now, we already have a clear problem with the North Koreans. By denuclearization, they mean no more U.S. troops left in Korea.
Right.
No nuclear umbrella.
Right.
No defense commitment to the Republic of Korea from the United States. And all nuclear capacity out. Now, we ought to look at the question, at least, are we prepared to pay that kind of price if we could get rid of North Korean nuclear weapons? Mm. What else is required? Certainly the thing there that I think is most concerning for me is that were a heavily conventionally armed North without nuclear weapons to attack the South with conventional weapons, wouldn't we be there and shouldn't we be there?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I wouldn't give up. If, in fact, the weapons could be taken out of the peninsula, all sides, and we were prepared to agree, that would be good for us because there are no U.S. weapons in Korea and there are no Korean nuclear weapons in
right.
Korea. I meant no nuclear weapons
right,
in Korea,
I know what you're
of course.
Right.
And so we would be getting a level playing field for one that has now been directly tilted against us. So it's an interesting question as to how we deal with that denuclearization issue. The second question is, should we try to get there all in one huge bound, that is, go from weapons to non-weapons, or are there steps that we can take? The problem here is deep distrust by Americans of North Koreans, and guess what?
Yeah.
Deep distrust of North Koreans about Americans. How do you build trust? It isn't blather. It isn't blah, blah. It isn't, you know, suddenly I love you, let me tell you how much I like you. It's basically action for action, fully inspected and verified over a long period of time. So why not take the freezes we now have in place, at least leading up to this discussion on North Korean nuclear and ICBM testing, at least, and put those in place permanently as long as we're working on full denuclearization. Why not have a situation in which the North Koreans have said to us, interestingly, they used to object to our exercises with the Republic of Korea. Maybe we can keep those exercises, but take away some of the problems that the North Koreans have seen, which really don't, I think, tremendously help us.
Right.
The decapitation of the North Korean leadership by one kind of strike or another isn't something we have to exercise. We know pretty well how to do that. And we could work on that at home rather than in Korea. But it is important that we keep the Koreans, who are our allies, the Republic of Korea, confident that we're there. We're not going to desert them in the effort to achieve denuclearization. And so those are the tricky questions that have to be addressed.
Two final questions. I know you're on a limited time schedule. You are a man who has a marvelous resume. You're widely respected. You were asked to chair the Benghazi review process, and critics slammed you for it. Did that bother you? Did that affect your professional worth?
Look, nobody likes to be criticized, so I won't tell you that it didn't hurt me. What I felt strongly about, however, was that I was criticized by things that I had an opportunity in the Congress and on the airwaves to defend, and I thought I had a strong defense. I took the job because, as a former U.S. government servant, when the Secretary of State comes and says, I have a tough job, will you do it? The answer is yes, it's got to be. The second point I thought was, this issue is going to be so totally tied up in American domestic politics that it isn't going to go away. So I'm going to be shirt-tailed in the ringer into this thing for a long time.
Absolutely.
And I took the job with both of those pieces in mind. Hmm. And I did the best job I could. And I had an enormously great committee to work with, particularly Mike Mullen, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs,
right.
A very cool man and a smart head. And the others were experts in their own field. And we put together a report, which I don't think anybody has torn apart. And I have to tell you, I spent a lot of time with the Congress, both in public and in private, answering their questions and testifying to this. And so did Admiral Mullen. And I don't think we have put it this way. We have left a big problem on the floor, in all honesty. The biggest concern was, why didn't we interview the Secretary of State? And the answer was, we interviewed everybody who knew what she had done and what she was doing, and we had no reason to question that, and we had no reason to question beyond that. That had answered our issues.
Last question, John Bolton. I don't. That's all I have to say. John Bolton, where do you go with that?
Well, John and I worked together.
Yeah.
John was the Assistant Secretary of State when I was the Ambassador to the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
We shared very few common views.
I can appreciate that.
Agree on nonproliferation.
Okay.
And John seems to agree on nonproliferation. I think we agreed that at the end, despite the fact that he wouldn't admit it in a direct sense, the UN was enormously helpful to us in the effort to deal with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait back in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he claims a great deal of credit for that success. He doesn't like the United Nations. So in effect, here he is on the one hand saying, this was a great success, and it was. We gained legitimacy by the United Nations, which allowed us to bring the U.S. Senate and Congress along with the use of force after they were tremendously affected by mission creep in Vietnam, and particularly the Democrats. And it was the UN deals that we put together that, in fact, helped to convince them to support what we had to do.
That's called situational ethics, Ambassador.
It is situational ethics in many ways. But, you know, every one of us in marriage and in life, as students and as teachers, are involved in figuring out not that there is a perfect ethical answer to every issue, but having to make those hard decisions, Peter.
You know, you and I almost ended up being Bowdoin alum.
Really?
They accepted your application. They didn't accept mine. But I was close.
Well, they made a serious mistake, my friend.
Well, and I tried to convince the admissions director.
Together we could have swung the world.
Ambassador Thomas Pickering, I could just chat with you for hours.
Thanks, Peter.
It's fascinating.
I enjoyed this immensely.
Please come back to New Hampshire and make this a stop when you come back.
I will. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Good. We have to take a break. We will be back with more.
With Peter St. James and Pat Kelly. Continues after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.